A call to servanthood. How do we go from sinful to servant? How does sinful Israel become a servant Israel? And the application is, how do we go from being sinners to becoming useful servants of God? The entire book is an appeal to abandon human pride, to trust in the Lord, accept His lordship over all of life, and to experience all of life as it was originally meant to be. And what was that? A reflection of God's holy image and the role of servant upon the earth. We're looking at the introduction. And the introduction to the book is in chapters 1 through 5. And we see the present and future of God's people. That's the introduction to the entire book. Now, chapters 1 through 5 are a powerful and general statement of the hopes and realities of Judah's current situation. The section moves back and forth between the two themes of doom and deliverance, which I've titled Bloom. Doom and Bloom. Chapter 1 is an introduction to the introduction. It introduces the introduction in a very sufficient way. Chapter 1 details Judah's situation in God's sight and calls them to Him. This is from my commentary, Oswalt, page 54. It's the grand arraignment. When you are indicted by grand jury or you get to go to court, they're going to bring you in and they're going to announce what you're being charged with. So this is very similar to that, that he's going to bring a charge against them, and then he's going to pronounce judgment upon them. Chapter 1 sets the stage for what follows throughout the whole book. It declares the inevitable destructive results of forsaking God. That's one of their primary charges, forsaking God, turning away from God. The foolishness of rote religion, the necessity of justice, the corruption of leadership, through it all, the possibility of redemption, return, and restoration. Now, we see in the first chapter three things: God's denunciation, His plea, and promise. We've already gone over the first two of these in the first message of chapter 1. God's denunciation and promise. Here he's going to tell them to listen, learn, and then live. Denunciation in verses 2 through 9, God's charge against Israel. She has forsaken the Lord, turned away from Him, and as a result is broken and desolate. God's plea to them, because of this, is for Israel to hear, listen, receive instruction, and to take the only reasonable action, which is going to be obedience and submission, so that they may be able to endure the judgment that's coming upon them. He says in verse 19:20, "If you are willing and obedient, you shall eat the good of the land. But if you refuse and rebel, you shall be devoured by the sword, for the mouth of the Lord has spoken." In other words, if you ignore Him, you will become ignorant and you'll receive death. Now, the promise is what we're going to be looking at today. God's promise of judgment, that is death, physical death, for rebels and sinners, and redemption, life, for repentant ones. First, we see God's response to the present realities. Isaiah turns to discuss the present condition of the nation and what God's response would be. Israel's condition is become so bad that destruction is inevitable. Destruction is not God's, of course, final purpose, but blessing through purification. God will avenge Himself against His enemies, verse 24. And it turns out that His own people is the enemy. But He avenges Himself against them in order to redeem them. His purpose for the nation is ultimately beneficial. The individual who insists on rebellion and ignorance, destruction is all they will know. It's beneficial for the whole nation. But within the nation, individuals who resist and rebel and remain in ignorance, destruction and death is all they will know. Now, here we have the announcement of judgment and then the fate of the wicked. First of all, the announcement of judgment. It takes the form of traditional classic judgment speech familiar out throughout the Old Testament and many of the prophets. It takes the form of prophetic judgment. For not only is it referred to a temporary judgment that's going to come upon the nation of Israel when he brings Babylon to them, surrounds them, and invades them, and deports them into captivity, and then the time they will spend in captivity, and then their restoration back to Israel, as we saw last week, Psalm 107, okay, it's going to prophetically take us even forward into the New Testament, into even the future. So many times throughout Isaiah, there's a short-term fulfillment, a intermediate or a medium-type fulfillment, and a long-term future fulfillment. So each of these announcements and much of the prophecy throughout Isaiah takes that form. Now, verses 21 through 23 gives the reason for the judgment, forsaking the Lord by turning to idols. Now let's turn to Isaiah chapter 1, verses 21 through 26, or 31, all right? And while you're there, let me mention that verses 24 through 26 is an announcement of judgment upon the nation, which comes through intervention, an intervention, like I said, with beneficial results. The expected natural result would be, you would think, annihilation or extermination, right? The nation is so bad, let's just wipe it out. Let's just start over. Like he proposed one time in the wilderness. And Moses said, no, don't do that. Don't annihilate them. Let's not do that. So, and then I was thinking about this passage here in Mark 13:20, where it says, unless the Lord had shortened those days, the days of the tribulation, which are very short in comparison to the time that 2,000 years since that time, said no flesh would be saved, extermination. But for the elect's sake, that is Israel, the chosen, whom he chosen, he shortened the days. The days were short. If the tribulation had been longer than 7 years, then all flesh would have perished, and no one would have been left alive, not only the elect. All right? So his purpose isn't annihilation. But as Orwell says, but in fact, the intended result is purification and reinstatement. So Israel's current condition, we see in verses 21 through 23, the reason for her judgment. Let me read that. I'm going to read in the New American Standard Bible that I got, and then on the screen you're going to have the New King James Version. Verse 21 says, how the faithful city has become a harlot. She who was full of justice, righteousness, once lodged in her, but now murderers. Your silver has become dross, your drink diluted with water. Your rulers are rebels and companions of thieves. Everyone loves a bribe and chases after rewards. They do not defend the orphan, nor does the widow's plea before them. We see in verse 21 how the faithful city has become a harlot. It was full of justice at one time, righteousness lodged in it, but now murderers. Now, the use of faithful city as Jerusalem is a representative of the whole nation as a whole. Israel's condition he describes as a prostitute who deserted the Lord for other lovers. So it's just like a wife, like in Hosea's case, who goes off and adulterates herself and prostitutes herself and becomes not the faithful a wife of her husband, but deserts him and follows after others. And that's what Israel has done. Now, the question is, when you read this, a faithful city, a city full of justice. Well, holy cow, when was that? Is this an actual past during the time of David and Solomon? Well, let me see. David, was that a faithful city when the time he was there? Well, wait a minute. He committed adultery and murder. All sorts of things were going on, right? What about Solomon? Oh, wait a minute. He had 700 wives. So when is Isaiah talking about? When was the city of Jerusalem faithful and righteous? Maybe this is maybe an idyllic or angelic past, like we think of the 1950s, the happy days. That's when things were really great, right? I don't remember much of it because I was born in late 50s. So I was like 1 or 2 years old. So all I remember is the 60s. And that was a bunch of turmoil. So is things so bad in Israel currently when he's writing this that he's thinking back to the time of David and Solomon, where in comparison to that time, the 1950s, kind of like the worst thing that happened in school was that kids talked in class, they ran in the hallway, and they chewed gum, right? But today we got guns and drugs and fights and so forth, knives, so forth. Is the time so bad for Israel that the times of David and Solomon look so good? It was considered a faithful and a righteous place. I'm not sure about that. I can't be too dogmatic about it. But I think those who are faithful embody the principles of justice and righteousness because their relationship to the one is righteous and just. Verse 22 and 23 says, "Your princes are rebellious. Your companions are thieves. Everyone loves a bribe and follows after rewards. They do not defend the fatherless, nor does the cause of the widow come before them." Boy, does this sound a lot like a modern government today? The ruling class, the elite, has perverted so that those who promote order, all right, careful, the nation has prostituted itself with other gods, and the leadership has become trash, useless. Instead of ruling, okay, they're rebellious and leading a rebellion. Now, Isaiah, as other prophets, make the connection between idolatry and social justice. He says, the widow, the orphan, and maybe even today, the infant child in the womb. Who are the most helpless? Well, some say, well, in times of things are bad, the women and children suffer the most. The poor suffer the most. Today, we have, who are the most vulnerable today? The child in the womb has no rights at all, can be just cut up into pieces and sucked out and thrown out in the trash. That's our leadership. That's what they think. That's how they see the vulnerable. All right. Verse 24 says, Therefore, the Lord... Now notice, it's capital L-O-R-D, small cap O-R-D. That is the word in Hebrew, if you're reading this Hebrew, would be the word Adonai. Therefore, the Lord, Adonai, says, the Lord... capital L, capital O, capital R, capital D, that's the word Yahweh, the Lord of hosts, the mighty one of Israel. Ah, or woe, I rid myself of my adversaries and take vengeance on my enemies. Now the word Adonai is the word sovereign or master. It has usually, when it's used, it has to have a negative connotation. You don't want Adonai showing up when he appears, all right? Because when he appears, things are going to get rough. Now, the word Yahweh comes from I am. That's his God's name, I am. What is your name? I am. The combined effect of these two names together is mastery, complete mastery, total dominance. The use of the word host, the Lord of hosts, means the vast army. God has a vast army of angels, okay, uncountable, innumerable, that he has available to him. And he's the mighty one of Israel. This is used oftentimes in a positive sense. When it's referred to the mighty one of Israel, it's like the cavalry. Here comes the cavalry, the mighty one of Israel, to save them from their enemies. All right? But, as Alwalt says, he who is mighty to save can also be mighty to destroy. All the more so because the enemy has become his own people. For 1 Peter, for the time has come for judgment to begin at the house of the Lord. When the church becomes... Okay? Stop doing that. All right. That's when judgment comes upon it. Hebrews 10:35b and 31. Again, the Lord will judge his people. If his people have become the enemy, he will judge them. It is a fearful thing to fall in the hands of a living God. He says, here's the announcement of judgment. Ah, or woe, I rid myself of my adversaries. I take vengeance on my enemies. You'll need to notice in these passages, beginning in verse 24 through 26, I will. God's determination. It's his sovereignty that's at work here. God's children are those who do his will, whoever they may be. In chapters 56, he talks about foreigners, non-Israelites, who come and they keep God's law. Whoever they may be, they become God's children. Whoever those who rebel are his enemies, though they may even be in Israel. All right, we're talking about in historical temporal senses, okay, not in the eternal sense, okay? God's children, all right, are those who do his will. Now, in Isaiah 57, 9 through 21, it says, peace, peace to him who is far off, that is the foreigner, and to him who is near, that is the Israelite, says the Lord, I will heal him. But the wicked are like the troubled sea when it cannot rest, whose waters cast up mire and dirt. There is no peace, says my God, for the wicked. If you are a foreigner doing wicked or you're an Israelite doing wicked, there will be trouble for you. If you are righteous and do rightly before God, there is peace for you. Verse 25 says, I will turn my hand against you and thoroughly purge away your dross and take away all your alloy. Here we get the sense of the purification of what's taking place. After a time of abandonment of the Lord himself from his people, the people abandon God, abandon the Lord, and as a result, the Lord's going to abandon them. But this abandonment by the Lord will put his hand upon them for purification. God's hand will not be upon them to completely destroy them, annihilate them, but to restore them. That's his ultimate purpose through all of this. Verse 25, I will restore your judges at the first and your counselors at the beginning. Israel needs just, impartial rulership, which will govern out of a sense of responsibility rather than greed. Now, he's setting the anticipation of what he's going to say later about, you know, and we're going to talk about this often time reverse in Christmas time. We're in Isaiah chapter 9, looks forward to one of these ruler who's going to come. A child will be born, a son will be given to us, and the government will rest on his shoulders, and his name will be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Eternal Father, peace upon peace, and there will be no end to the increase of his government or his peace on the throne of David and over his kingdom to establish it and to uphold it with justice and righteousness for then and forevermore. The zeal of the Lord, a host, will accomplish this. So the current condition of Israel is that the rulers are corrupt and they're trash. But there's coming a time when he will restore, and it's coming to come through the coming child that will be born, the King of Kings that will bring peace, the Prince of Peace. Then he says, afterwards, you shall be called, again, the City of Righteousness, the Faithful City. Israel will be restored to the vision of what she is called to be, originally called to be, after passing as through fire. Now, let's read the fate of the wicked, verses 27 through 31. Here I'm again reading from the New American Standard first. Zion will be redeemed with justice, and the repentant ones with righteousness. But transgressors and sinners will be crushed together, and those who forsake the Lord shall come to an end. Surely you will be ashamed of the oaks which you have desired, and you will be embarrassed at the gardens which you have chosen. For you will be like an oak whose leaf fades away, or a garden that has no water. The strong man who becomes tender, his work also a spark. Thus they shall both burn together, and there will be none to quench them. First, we see in sections 27 through 30, which concludes the introduction to the introduction, chapters 2 through 5. It's similar to the conclusion to the longer introduction, verses 24 through 30, and the concluding verse of the book. So let me read verses from chapter 5, 24 through 30, which is the conclusion to the major introduction. It's a rather long passage. I guess we have time for that, maybe. It says, therefore, as a tongue of fire consumes stubble, a dry grass collapses into a flame, so their root will become like root, and their bosom blown away as dust. For they have rejected the Lord of hosts and despised the word of the Holy One. There's their condition. On this account, the anger of the Lord has burned against his people, and he has stretched out his hand against them and struck them down, and the mountains quaked, and their corpses lay like refuse in the middle of the streets. For all his anger has been spent, his hand is still stretched out. He will also lift up a standard to the distant nation, and will whistle for it from the ends of the earth. And behold, it will come with speed swiftly. He go, come on, nations, come on in here and wipe out Israel. No one in this weary or will stumble, no slumbers or sleeps, nor is the belt at his waist undone, nor is the sandal strap broken. Its arrows and are sharp, and its bows are bent. The hoofs of its horses seem like flint, and its chariots wheels like whirlwind. Its roaring is like a lion, and it roars like young lions. It growls as it seizes the prey and carries it off with no one to deliver it. And it shall growl over it in the day like the roaring of the sea. If one looks at the land, and behold, there is darkness and distress, even the light is darkness by its clouds. So that's how the introduction, the conclusion to the introduction ends, with darkness and the nations roaring. Look what we did. We scored a touchdown or something. We devoured the nation of Israel. Look at us. We're how great we are, right? Well, later on, God's going to have a message to those people those nations who came against Israel. They'll have their day of judgment as well. Now, then in chapter 6, what's that? Anybody know what happens in chapter 6? In the year King Uzziah death, I saw the Lord sitting on his throne, aloft and exalted, with the train of his robe filling the temple. That's when Isaiah gets this vision of the Lord. He sees the Lord and the light of his coming. Now, let's look at the last verse in the entire book, which is the conclusion to the entire book. Chapter 66, verse 24. He says this, "Then they shall go forth and look on the corpses of men who have transgressed against me, for their worm shall not die, and their fire shall not be quenched, and they shall be an abhorrence to all mankind." So that's the conclusion to the whole book, that the doom and gloom, but then there is the bloom. The point to note here is this: continued arrogance, rebellion, continued arrogant rebellion against God will result in destruction, no matter who you are. If you're the foreigner or you're the Israelite, if you are a pagan out there in the world today, or if you're disobedient in the church, you will receive destruction in your life. The mighty will perish. Their judgment is sure. Verse 27. Now we go back to Isaiah chapter 27, where he says this, "Zion shall be redeemed with justice, and repentant ones with righteousness." Now here's a transitional verse between the purification from the repentant ones, which we mentioned earlier, and the destruction of the rebellious. The concept of Zion is a favorite of Isaiah, occurs 47 times in the book. It's also used quite often in Micah and in the Psalms. Zion is the mountain by which Jerusalem sat. It's the hill. Zionism, you've heard. Zion depicts chosenness, hope, and beauty for those who belong to God. The imagery is doubly effective when Zion is said to be desolate and destroyed. So it's going to be desolate and then restored. Zion is to be redeemed as a gift of God. Her desolation and destruction is only passing. The use of the concept redeemed suggests that the chapter consciously introduces the entire book. But much more in that concept of redeem is predominant more in chapters 40 through 66. As we sang, redeem, redeem, right? What is the source, though, of all righteousness and justice? Is it not through his gracious gift? That's what we call the imputed righteousness. How do we get righteous? Well, in one sense, we have received the imputed righteousness of God. And standing before God, we are righteous. But in a practical sense, we are still sinners. So those who dispose themselves toward the righteousness and justice which he has made possible will be saved. And those who do not are destroyed. As Isaiah says in chapter 56, verse 1, "Keep justice, do righteousness, for my salvation is about to come, and my righteousness to be received." Now notice that you have to keep justice and righteousness to receive salvation in this sense. Okay? So it would be more of the imparted righteousness that we receive. The salvation we receive is a result of doing justice and being right. As humanity chooses to do what God makes possible, restoration and redemption occurs practically in one's life. The destruction, verse 28, of transgressors and sinners shall be together, and those who forsake the Lord shall be consumed. Those who refuse what God makes possible find only death and destruction. Verse 29:30, he says, "For they shall be ashamed of the..." This is the King James, uses the word terebinth, which basically is an oak tree or oak type tree, which you desired. You shall be embarrassed because of the gardens which you have chosen. For you shall be as an oak whose leaf fades in a garden that has no water. What did they do? They forsook God. And these verses make plain that it's the worship of idols to which rebellion and forsaking God refer to. It's the sin that is the forsaking of God. They forsook God in the wilderness for a golden calf. They forsaking God to worship Baal. Today, people forsake God to worship money or power or whatever it is. Whatever takes the place of placing God first in our lives and making Him first in our lives is what forsaking God is. Jeremiah says this, I will utter my judgments against them concerning all their wickedness, because they have forsaken me, burned incense to other gods, and worshipped the works of their own hands. Now, the use of the word oaks refers to sacred groves and gardens which were part of the fertility cult of Baal. Even today, people like here on the left in India, they worship trees, they worship gardens. Remember the movie Avatar? Anybody see the movie Avatar? Anybody see? Okay. It's on TV all the time, maybe. What do? It's the sacred mother tree of the planet, whatever. What's the name of the planet there? And the people there are all worshiping the tree, that the mother of life. Okay? That's the concept and the idea that the Hollywood's trying to put into people. That nature itself is to be worshipped. And many people worship trees. To leave God who made the trees in order to worship the tree is the height of folly. To put trust in the creation is to have that trust betrayed. How foolish then, Oswald says, that when God has chosen Judah, that Judah has chosen a tree. If you go to the animal kingdom in Disney World, they have the tree of life. I don't know what they're trying to tell you there. The tree of life? God is the source of all life, not trees, right? The creation is not the source of life. Gods, who have no creative power in themselves, those who depend upon the creation are doomed to wither and dry up. Oswald concludes, says, those who choose the garden and those chose the garden and there was no water. Choose the garden and there's no water. Choose the one who made the garden and there is streams of living water. The strong, concluding verse in the chapter, the strong shall be as tinder and the work of it as a spark. Both will burn together, and no one shall quench them. Tinder, in the Scouts, we teach fire building. And the things that you use to start a fire is tinder. It's the easiest thing to get started. You don't start with a log. We talk about four steps. There's tinder, and I'd like to call twigs, sticks, and logs. Okay? Twigs are like tiny sticks, and then sticks are bigger, about this big around, and logs, of course, are bigger. So you use tinder to start a fire. It's the easiest thing to burn. And that's what those who trust in idols, the mighty of the earth, who worship some mighty tree, will be stripped bare, revealing that they were not mighty after all. They are just chaff, good for nothing but burning. Now the conclusion to this message. God promises that in the future that Israel will be glorious as the cedars of Lebanon and Carmel. Great cedar tree. I don't know if you've seen too many. There are not too many around. I don't see any around here. There was one I saw in Virginia once, and it looks like an oak, but it has leaves like a pine tree. It's kind of strange when you first look at it. It's a mighty tree. And the cedar, if it's aged long enough, is a very, very hard wood. And God describes Israel as being like a cedar tree, strong and beautiful one day. God does not destroy the forest of human pride to leave a field of stumps. Rather, the destruction is in order that the true glory of humanity derived from the Lord may appear. And we'll conclude with a message from Isaiah, last chapter again, where he says this about the whole creation. As a new heaven and a new earth, which I will make, shall remain before me, says the Lord, so shall your descendants and your name remain, and shall come to pass. All flesh shall come to worship before me, says the Lord.